Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 2.31, The Raid on the Sublime Porte, The Balkan Wars, Part 2. So, first things first, I know, I said last week at the end of last episode, and now it's been, a month? My bad, no excuse really, just life. I work as a tutor and things always get hectic heading into the school year. Plus, I've been soaking up time with my 16-month-old daughter. All that to say, thank you so much for your patience. But let's now get back into it. Last time, we left the Ottoman Empire reeling from disaster. The Balkan League, Bulgaria, Serbia, Greece, and Montenegro, had crushed the Ottoman army on every front, sweeping through Ottoman Europe like a stampede. In just 6 weeks, the Christian armies had overrun Kosovo, Albania, Thrace, and Macedonia. In late October 1912, the Greeks occupied Salonika, heart of Macedonia and the birthplace of the Young Turk Revolution and the CUP itself. In early November, the Bulgarians besieged Edirne, capital of Thrace and home to Mehmed Talat. A week later, the Serbs took Monastir, hometown of Ismail Enver. The Ottomans managed one bright spot at the Battle of Çatalca when they halted the Bulgarians just short of Istanbul, but the rest of Thrace was gone. By December, Ottoman Europe had been lost. 6 centuries of imperial rule in the Balkans ended almost overnight. An armistice was signed on December the 3rd, and the great powers began peace talks in London. So this was the apocalyptic scene into which Ismail Enver now returned to Istanbul. Enemy troops at the capital's doorstep, Muslim refugees flooding in with stories of atrocities, and the government preparing to accept a humiliating peace. Within days, Enver was plotting with other leaders of the CUP's Sacred Committee to overthrow the government. The most important of these co-conspirators was Mehmed Talat, who had spent the war quietly working the capital's political underground. Ironically, being ousted from power earlier that year in the Savior Officers' Coup had actually spared the CUP from blame for this recent catastrophe. Responsibility fell instead on the quote-unquote liberal government of Kamil Pasha. Now, I say quote-unquote liberal because while the cabinet did have some reform-minded ministers, Kamil's government was not liberal in any sense that a modern observer would recognize. That label comes from the fact that the immediate beneficiaries of the Savior Officers' Coup earlier that year had been the Freedom and Accord Party, a party often shorthanded as the Liberals. But what held this party together most of all was a shared opposition to the CUP. These are the non-unionist Young Turks. In their opposition to the CUP, this group tended to favor decentralization and a generally more inclusive vision of Ottomanism that allowed for limited autonomy for ethnic minority groups. But even so, the Grand Vizier, Kamil himself, was above all else a very old and very experienced politician from the Hamidian era, who had served as Grand Vizier under Sultan Abdul Hamid on 3 different occasions, going all the way back to the 1880s. By 1913, Kamil was 80 years old. Or in other words, he was certainly not a young Turk, but a relic of a bygone era. But anyways, as the First Balkan War turned into the Balkan Disaster, Kamil's popularity quickly collapsed, and the CUP did everything it could to hasten his fall. Talat would lead this effort, and he would become the face of radical street politics, emerging as a populist voice for a wounded and humiliated Muslim public. Kamil's government wanted peace, in an approach that was pragmatic, diplomatic, and grounded in the familiar game of balancing great power rivalries. This strategy had helped Abdul Hamid and his ministers to navigate the dangerous waters of great power politics on many, many different occasions. The CUP, which was mostly made up of young, patriotic, and kind of hot-headed officers, wanted war. Not for territory alone, but to reclaim the honor and dignity of the nation through armed struggle. For the liberals, the survival of the empire meant compromise. For the CUP, it meant striking back. But going into January 1913, the general mood in Istanbul and amongst the officer corps was aligned with the CUP's call for a renewed war. So the question no longer became whether the government would fall, but instead when and who would be ready to take its place. By mid-January, all the pieces for a CUP coup were in place. On January the 17th, the Great Powers issued a joint note to the Ottoman government, pressing for a final peace settlement and demanding the cession of Edirne, or Adrianople. For the CUP, this was intolerable. Edirne held a special symbolic significance for the empire because it had been the Ottoman capital even before the conquest of Istanbul, going all the way back to 1362. So, having been a central part of the empire for over half a millennia, the loss of Edirne was almost inconceivable. For Mehmed Talat, a native son of Edirne, the loss of the city was also personal. Saving Edirne became the rallying cry of anti-government agitation in Istanbul. Leading members of the CUP under Talat's lead began preparing for a coup, and popular unrest spread throughout the capital. By January the 22nd, it had become clear that Grand Vizier Kamil Pasha's government intended to accept the terms and to surrender Edirne. That day, Grand Vizier Kamil convened a grand council of religious, civil, judicial, and military leaders to vote on the proposed peace terms. This vote came back 69-1 in favor of peace at any cost. So it was now crystal clear that Kamil's government intended to surrender Edirne, and so the CUP made their move. The following morning, on January the 23rd, hundreds of angry demonstrators, many organized by CUP agents, filled the square outside the Sublime Porte. Flags snapped in the winter wind, chants to save Edirne echoed against the stone walls of the government quarter. Inside the building, Kamil's ministers were in the midst of delicate talks with a visiting German delegation over a crucial loan. Around midday, Enver, Talat, and Cemal, the men who would later that year emerge as the Three Pashas Triumvirate, arrived on the scene on horseback. The crowd parted and allowed them to approach the doors of the Sublime Porte, which they did with some ease as the CUP had already arranged for Unionist officers to be on guard duty that day. Then, during the demonstration, Unionist agents cut the telephone lines to the building, leaving the ministers isolated inside. At 2 p.m., the three men formed a small raiding party of around 50 officers, and they then forced their way through the front doors. Moments later, gunfire rang out in the corridors. Hearing the shouts, the war minister, Nazim Pasha, rushed down the stairs. "What is going on?" he shouted. "You came to raid the Grand Vizier's office?" he asked imploringly. Enver, momentarily taken aback, allegedly saluted his superior and tried to explain himself. But in the chaos, CUP gunman Yakub Cemil stepped forward and shot the war minister dead. Some witnesses would later insist that Enver had tried to stop the shooting. Others claimed he simply froze. Talat proved to be much more decisive. Taking control of the situation, Talat led the party down the hall and burst into Kamil Pasha's office, waving his pistol. Enver trailed behind him somewhat reluctantly at first. Upon entering, Enver addressed the 80-year-old Grand Vizier with stiff, almost ceremonial respect. Talat did not bother with such niceties. Hans Lucas Kaiser's biography captures Talat in this moment perfectly, saying, quote, "He combined charm and intimidation, resolution and brutality." Even though he had entered the office hesitantly at first, Enver quickly gathered himself and took on Talat's aggressive and intimidating posture as well. Enver drew his pistol, leveled it at Kamil's head, and demanded his resignation. In a telling anecdote, Kamil's draft letter initially read, quote, "In response to a proposal by the military." Talat ordered him to change it, to say, quote, "In response to a proposal by the people and the military." Talat would continue to claim that he had simply enacted the will of the Ottoman people. Enver then took this revised letter and took it straight to Sultan Mehmed V. His explanation of the day's events was that of a reluctant and somewhat delusional patriot, saying, quote, "I sincerely regret having been forced to intervene again to overthrow a government, but it was impossible to wait. A delay of a few hours and the country would have been shamefully delivered to the enemy. Our army has never been stronger, and I really see no reason that compels us to capitulate to such monstrous demands. Inver has often been positioned as the primary actor during the raid on the Sublime Porte. However, Inver's initial reluctance during the raid and his somewhat ashamed explanations afterward reveal Talat as the primary driver of events. Inver had been the one who leveled his pistol at Camille and compelled his resignation on the spot. Yet it was Talat's political intensity, not Inver's military theatrics, that gave the raid its calculated momentum. Inver provided the coercion, Talat provided the direction. This dynamic would carry forward in later years. Talat remained at the Sublime Porte following the raid and temporarily established dictatorial control of the government. The translator from the German delegation, who were trapped in the building, described Talat as, quote, immediately taking real state power and establishing, quote, absolute authority over the whole building. Knowing the power of public opinion from his experience as a CUP propagandist in Macedonia and more recently in Istanbul, Talat immediately began sending telegrams out to the provinces. These messages claimed that Camille's government had intended to give up Edirne, and in response, the outraged Ottoman people had demonstrated in front of the Sublime Porte to demand the cabinet's resignation. Talat claimed he had simply acted on behalf of this outraged nation. Talat then declared, somewhat ominously, quote, the new government will protect the honor of the nation. I give you the holy promise that even if 80,000 Turkish martyrs cover the earth between Adrianople and Çatalca, we prefer heroic death to renouncing Adrianople. In the weeks after the putsch, the CUP moved swiftly to crush their political rivals. The crackdown was as much revenge as it was political necessity. In the tense days before the raid, Camille Pasha's government had arrested and harassed leading unionists, rightly suspecting that the CUP was plotting to overthrow them. Talat himself had only escaped arrest thanks to his immense popularity in the streets, and because Camille's ministers feared that detaining him might spark an insurrection. One foreign observer, weary of the endless political swings in Istanbul, summed it up neatly, saying, quote, everybody is by turns minister or prisoner. Now that the CUP held the upper hand, it was the liberals' turn to face the jailers. Yet even in their moment of triumph, the CUP stuck to their post-1908 strategy, which was ruling from the shadows. The CUP had always preferred to act as vigilant overseers rather than sitting in the ministerial hot seat themselves. The raid on the Sublime Porte was now the third time they had intervened to topple a government they believed was about to surrender territory to the Balkan states and their great power backers. So, once again, instead of taking the Grand Vizier's office themselves, Talat and Enver turned to General Mahmud Shevket, hero of the 1909 counter-coup and commander of the Action Army, to form a new cabinet. Mahmud Shevket accepted and emerged from the raid with more power than ever before. Not only was the general made Grand Vizier, but also war minister, foreign minister, and field marshal. Still, Shevket was never fully the CUP's man. Their first choice for Grand Vizier had actually been Nazim Pasha, the very man killed in the Sublime Porte firefight. That irony gives weight to claims that Enver really had tried to stop Yakub Cemil from pulling the trigger. It seems that his murder may have actually been an unfortunate accident, and that the CUP saw Nazim as one of their few allies in Camille's government. But whatever the backroom intentions, Mahmud Shevket would form a new government in early 1913. And though the cabinet was backed by the CUP, it was still anchored in Shevket's own military power base and widely seen as a government of national unity, a coalition built for a single urgent purpose, to organize a campaign that might drive the Balkan League back out of Ottoman Europe. So, for now, the CUP remained what it had been since 1908, a secretive committee pulling the strings of power from behind the curtain, letting others occupy the Grand Vizier's chair. The open CUP dictatorship was still months away at this point, but the road to it was already being laid. And at the center of this process stood Mehmed Talat. In the wake of January 1913, Talat emerged as the undisputed leader of the CUP's Sacred Committee. Rank-and-file unionists saw the putsch as his handiwork. One veteran member recalled, quote, "Afterward, everybody believed in him as their true head, with endless trust." Talat's ascendancy within the party marked more than just personal dominance. It signaled the CUP's full embrace of his style: aggressive, authoritarian, and unabashedly populist. From this moment on, the party's political identity would increasingly be Talat's political identity. And once the CUP finally steps out from behind the curtain to rule openly, it will be Talat who will wear the crown. The dictatorship will be called the Three Pashas and include Enver and Jamal, but Talat will be first among equals. But for the time being, Talat was still content to let Mahmoud Shevket's government do the visible work of governing while he pulled the strings from the shadows. And for Shevket's new cabinet, one issue towered above all others: the fate of the peace talks over in London. The first major consequence of the raid on the Sublime Porte was immediate. In late January, the Ottoman delegation in London walked out of the negotiations and refused to cede Edirne, or Adrianople. Shevket and the CUP were gambling that the Balkan League's fragile alliance could not last. If they held firm, perhaps another war would break out between the Balkan states before the Ottomans had to surrender the city. But in the short term, this gamble would be a disaster. The Bulgarians resumed their bombardment of Edirne and pressed the Çatalca line on the outskirts of Istanbul. In early February, Serbian heavy siege guns joined the Bulgarian batteries, tightening the noose. By late March, after 5 months under siege, Edirne was starving and dying. Food was nearly gone, disease was rampant, Bulgarian cavalry were now slipping through the lines. And on March the 26th, the Ottoman commander finally surrendered. 2 weeks later, on April the 15th, the Bulgarians agreed to an armistice at Çatalca. But farther to the west, the rest of Ottoman Europe was collapsing. The Greeks captured Yanina in Epirus, today in northern Greece, on March the 6th. The Montenegrins took Skutari, or Shkodër, in northern Albania just a week later. So, in the end, the CUP's defiant stand had brought no gains, only tens of thousands of new casualties, and the final loss of nearly every Ottoman stronghold in Europe. They had reignited the war to regain national honor, but instead they had brought only further humiliation and suffering. The First Balkan War officially ended on May 30th, 1913, with the signing of the Treaty of London. But since the Ottoman delegation had left the conference in January, they were not signatories. But the great powers declared that all Ottoman territory west of a line just outside Istanbul, called the Anos Media Line, would be ceded to the Balkan League. Humiliating terms that Shevket's government never formally accepted. Now, there is one aside that we must discuss while we are talking about the Treaty of London, and that is Albania. The fate of Albania consumed much of the great powers' time in London. During the war, Montenegro and Serbia had overrun most of the Albanian lands of the Ottoman Empire, but Austria-Hungary and Italy in particular were determined to block Serbia from keeping it. The idea of a greater Serbia with a port on the Adriatic was very alarming to Vienna, not only because Austria and Serbia had nearly gone to war in the Bosnian crisis just 5 years earlier, but also because Serbia was drawing ever closer to Russia. So, even without the Ottomans at the negotiating table, the great powers shut down Serbia and Montenegro's claims, meaning the Albanian question was kicked down the road, as the treaty stated that the fate of Albania would be determined by a great power delegation at a later date. Now, the Albanians themselves had actually already declared independence in late November 1912. But as so often was the case during this era, self-determination required a powerful patron. So, our old friend Ismail Kemal, former delegate in the Ottoman parliament and the leader of the All-Albanian Congress that issued the independence declaration, moved quickly to court Vienna and Rome as protectors. For just over a year, through the final stages of the Balkan Wars, Ismail Kemal headed Albania's provisional government as prime minister, navigating both local factionalism and the designs of the great powers. By January 1914, these forces would overwhelm Kemal, forcing his resignation and ending his political career in Albania. So, the man who did so much over the years to further the Albanian cause, and who I once introduced as the future founding father of Albania, was now simply the founding father of Albania. But he would quickly be relegated to the status of a national figure, without any real power in the new order. Like so many Ottoman-era leaders, he would be swept aside as a new world emerged after the Great War. Albania's final and secure independence would not come until the post-war peace settlements in Paris, years after Kemal's departure from the political stage. But now, we return to Istanbul in 1913. For the government under Mahmud Shevket and the CUP, the potential loss of Albania was honestly the least of their worries. Because even if the ultimate status of Albania was left uncertain in the Treaty of London, the final terms stipulated that the Ottomans would lose 60,000 square miles of territory and close to 4 million inhabitants. The magnitude of this loss is hard to overstate. And yet, there was still a glimmer of hope. On June the 1st, just one day after the treaty was signed, Greece and Serbia concluded a formal alliance pledging to keep Bulgaria out of Macedonia. Before the war, Bulgaria and Serbia had agreed on a division of the spoils, leaving a central disputed zone in Macedonia to be arbitrated by Russia. On the ground, however, the situation was already tilting against Bulgaria. The Greek army had occupied Salonika a day before Bulgarian troops arrived, boxing them out of the city entirely. Bulgaria had also concentrated its forces in Thrace, east of Macedonia, closer to Istanbul, where the fiercest fighting took place. The capture of Edirne and the assault of the Çatalca Line had been decisive in defeating the Ottomans, and the Bulgarians believed these sacrifices entitled them to generous compensation. But with fewer Bulgarian troops in Macedonia, they lacked physical control of the territory. And as the old saying goes, possession is 9/10 of the law. Serbia, Greece, and Montenegro held most of Macedonia and were determined to keep it. For Bulgaria, the math seemed clear. They had borne the brunt of the war, seized Edirne, and pushed the Ottomans back to Istanbul. They wanted not only the disputed zone promised before the war, but a larger share of Macedonia. Yet Serbia, Greece, and Montenegro had no intention of yielding an inch. The Greek-Serbian alliance was a blunt warning. The other victors were closing ranks against them. So, in Sofia, the mood turned grim. The dream of a greater Bulgaria, so close after the triumphs of 1912, now seemed under siege by former allies. Bulgarian politicians thundered in parliament, officers seethed in the barracks, and the press clamored for action. The alliance that had shattered the Ottomans was coming apart, and within weeks, the dispute over Macedonia would ignite the Second Balkan War. Throughout June 1913, the Bulgarian army gradually shifted west from Thrace into Macedonia. Small clashes with Serbian and Greek forces broke out, even as no formal declaration of war had been made. Diplomacy then soon collapsed. Bulgaria now demanded not only the entire disputed zone in Macedonia, but also territory held by Greece. And then on the night of June the 29th, Bulgarian troops launched a surprise attack along the Macedonian front. They hoped to catch the Serbs and Greeks off guard, to seize ground quickly, and to claim it by force. But their opponents were better prepared than expected, and within days, Serbia and Greece counterattacked effectively. The Bulgarian gamble would backfire catastrophically and expose their diplomatic isolation. By mid-July, nearly every other Balkan state now saw an opportunity in Bulgaria's overextension. Romania, which had stayed out of the First Balkan War, invaded southern Dobruja on July the 10th, territory long coveted in Bucharest and now left dangerously exposed. 2 days later, the Ottomans struck from the east, launching an offensive into eastern Thrace aimed at retaking Edirne. Bulgaria now faced a war on four fronts, against Romania, Serbia, Greece, Montenegro, and the Ottoman Empire. The Second Balkan War would be short and decisive, lasting barely over a month, and Bulgaria would collapse on all fronts. For the Ottomans, the reopening of war brought a rare chance at redemption, and for Ismail Enver, a moment of personal triumph. On July 20th, an Ottoman force of more than 200,000 crossed the Anos Media line into Bulgarian-held territory. Outnumbered and overextended, Bulgarian forces fell back toward their pre-war border. In their retreat, the Bulgarians abandoned Edirne, which they had seized only months earlier. The Ottomans initially advanced cautiously, but as Bulgarian resistance crumbled, the city lay wide open. Then, on July the 23rd, with no Bulgarian defenders left, Enver made a dramatic entry into Edirne. The stunt played brilliantly in the press. The Hero of Liberty from 1908 was now celebrated as the Second Conqueror of Edirne, a title first held by Sultan Murad I in the 1360s. This elevation reflected the near-mythical status Enver gained on that day. Enver's dramatic re-entry into Edirne catapulted him and the CUP into unprecedented popularity. He claimed the recapture as his own personal victory, boasting, quote, "Now I have entered Edirne. The Bulgarians are retreating. I have taken artillery and equipment." And, quote, "I am happy as a child for having been the only one who could leap into Edirne in just one night." The Ottoman public embraced this heroic narrative without hesitation. After years of humiliation, the victory offered a rare spark of optimism, and that optimism now bore the CUP's stamp. To the Unionists, it also confirmed what they had always claimed, that only their party had the resolve to defend the empire when others faltered. Kamil Pasha's liberals had been ready to give up Edirne. Enver, Talat, and Jamal had refused, and then been proven right. Most importantly, the CUP leaders themselves drew that very lesson. From the Spalanport coup in January to the hard-fought campaign in Thrace, the year's events seemed proof that only a strong, decisive, and if necessary, authoritarian leadership could save the state. The constitutional restraints of 1908 now looked like luxuries they could no longer afford. But victory was tempered by what Enver saw when he entered Edirne. The city was devastated. Thousands starving and sick, streets crowded with muhajir, Muslim refugees fleeing the atrocities in Macedonia, Albania, and Kosovo. Similar scenes played out in Istanbul, hardening Talat and Jamal's conviction that the empire's Christian neighbors were existential enemies. The Balkan Wars had brought modern ethnic cleansing to southeastern Europe. Because the Christian states had won, it was Muslim communities, often in the very homelands of the Young Turk leadership, who suffered the worst. By the war's end, millions of Muslim refugees had poured into the empire. The mood among Unionist leaders turned dark. One veteran captured the feeling, saying, quote, "My whole spirit, my entire being screams vengeance, vengeance. Pity be upon us as Turks, as Ottomans, if we do not scream vengeance." Enver echoed the same letter in a letter to his wife, saying, quote, "The savagery the enemy has inflicted, a stone's throw from Istanbul. But our anger is strengthening. Revenge, revenge, revenge. There is no other word." Even though they credited themselves with the victory, the Unionists had not been the only ones to help organize the national effort to save Edirne. And it would take a series of dramatic domestic events to finally bring the CUP into open, permanent control of the Ottoman government. On July the 11th, 1913, in the midst of the devastation left by the Balkan Wars, Grand Vizier Mahmud Shevket was riding through Bayezid Square in Istanbul when his carriage was ambushed. Gunmen in another vehicle opened fire in broad daylight, at least five shooters firing 10 shots, killing Shevket instantly. The scene was chaotic. The assassin most directly linked to the shooting was said to be a relative of Nazim Pasha, the war minister killed during the January raid on the Spalanport. But the scale and coordination of the attack suggested broader political involvement. Many suspected ties to the Liberal Freedom and Accord Party, which had been ousted in that same January coup. If the aim had been to weaken the Unionists, though, the result was the opposite. The CUP seized the moment to crush their political enemies. Dozens of arrests followed, including many prominent liberal figures. Prince Sabah ad-Din, long the standard-bearer of anti-Unionist politics, fled to Paris. While the party would briefly resurface after World War I, in practical terms, the Liberal Freedom and Accord Party ceased to exist after Shevket's murder and the repression that followed. Shevket's successor was Sayyid Halim Pasha, the first Grand Vizier drawn from the CUP's own ranks. Sayyid Halim, who had been the party's general secretary during the Balkan Wars, was also the grandson of Muhammad Ali, the founder of modern Egypt, bringing our story full circle, as we first introduced Muhammad Ali way back in episodes 1.9 and 1.10. The cabinet of Sayyid Halim was the first openly and fully unionist government. Talat became Minister of the Interior. Jamal retained his post as military governor of Istanbul, a role he had held since the January coup, and he also now took on the Ministry of Public Works. Enver, only 32 at the time, had to wait a few months due to his age before being appointed Minister of War in January 1914. By the end of 1913, the CUP dictatorship was no longer operating in the shadows. It was fully out in the open and dominated by three men: Enver, Jamal, and especially Talat. In just half a year, the Ottoman Empire had gone from humiliation and near collapse to military redemption and one-party rule. The men who now held power believed that only they had the resolve and commitment necessary to protect the empire from imminent collapse, and they would stop at nothing to save the state. The victories of 1913 had come at a terrible price, but the disasters of the years ahead would prove far worse. So, join me next episode as we bring this season to a close and trace the beginnings of the CUP dictatorship in The Three Pashas.